Welcome to Commas.
Commas is all things tech.
We see culture and technology coming together.
Life hacks.
The practicality right now in the inefficiency of the internet of buying and selling stuff is extraordinary.
Entrepreneurship advice.
I think the first thing is you got to understand your business inside out.
Love and tech.
We've almost reduced dating to kind of this very momentary snap of a person.
It's going to be a fire show.
I have yet to see something these days that's truly differentiated.
New advice and new inspiration every show.
This really is about the next generation of creators going faster, further than we did.
And now, Sequoia Blodgett.
Now let's start stacking them commas.
On this episode, we catch up with former Blavity founder John Jackson and discuss what it means to leave your company as a founder.
Entrepreneurship advice. Learn from the hottest and most successful investors, founders, and innovators in the game.
Determine your greatness.
It's time to get your knowledge up.
Okay, for sure.
What's poppin'? We've got John Jackson on the line, founder of Blavity, one of the four founders of Blavity. I am so excited to be talking to you because there are so many gems and so much knowledge that I believe you have that I know that our audience is going to benefit from. So how are you?
I'm doing super well. How are you doing?
I am so good. Okay, so just for the folks who don't know, let's get into your background. Where did you start and then what got you to the point of starting Blavity?
Yeah, so my background, I think it's super important to kind of contextualize sort of how people think, because I think it's really easy to like look at somebody's story and just cherry pick the things you know about them. So I would not say that I was entrepreneurial in the way that a lot of people's stories are. Like, I hadn't ever started a first business. I wasn't one of those kids who was selling like candy in the lockers, but I do think I had entrepreneurial thought patterns. That is to say, I was pretty contrarian. So when people went left, I would be like, but why go left? And like, what does going left mean?
Right.
Which, you know, I think is really useful in the entrepreneurial space. But in middle school, that usually gets you like caught up in some parent teacher conferences because I was a problem in the classroom. I was legitimately so. But I credit my parents with kind of helping me foster that creativity at home and making sure I had the ability to ask questions. And if they didn't have the answers, they never pretended to. But
That's
what they
true.
Did say is that you need to make sure you go find the right source material before you bring something to the public. So you need to make sure that you have the right information to stand behind whatever claims you make. So as a student, I think I was kind of always sort of scatterbrained. I wanted to do a bunch of stuff. I went to college in St. Louis at Washington University in St. Louis, which is where Morgan, Aaron, and Jeff all went. So we're all a year removed in graduation year. I'm the youngest. So I graduated in 2013. And sort of on campus, like when I got there a semester late. So there was a program at the time called the January program. So they would pick about 50 to 60 kids inside of an incoming freshman class. And because of the way housing was kind of set up, they would choose kids who they thought could acculturate into school okay, but you wouldn't start until second semester. So I actually didn't start college until the spring semester. Which kind of made me feel like I was like a semester behind and whatnot. But when I got there, I realized like I was just trying to figure out like what was going on campus, who to know, how to make friends and stuff like that. And sort of respectively in their own rights, like Morgan, Aaron, and Jeff were just people of real substance on campus. So Jeff was student body president. Morgan was student body president after him. Aaron was like an incredibly well-known poet, author, speaker. So, you know, just generally speaking by who they were, I knew of them, and I was still trying to figure my way out and kind of carve my own little niche. But that's sort of the breeding ground for how we all met. And I think going to school in St. Louis was important to me for a couple reasons. One, it was the furthest I had been from the East Coast, for any dedicated period of time. And I think that allowed me to kind of blossom in some specific ways. And then also just learn a different kind of independence. I think there's like the independence you have from sort of your neighborhood, what makes you comfortable. And then there's intellectual independence. So like, are you able to think about things and come to conclusions given a variety of different sources? So how do you put together arguments that are salient that you can present, but that are also malleable, that you can also add new information in and process and all that stuff. And so that was really formative for me. I studied political science, and I never wanted to be a lawyer, but I spent a lot of time understanding like how laws get passed and what gerrymandering and district means and research methods and stuff like that, because I'm super nerdy. And WASHI was a place where you could be super nerdy as a research institution, and that was really big for me. When everyone graduated, everyone kind of went in their own direction, and I ended up making my way to San Francisco to work at LinkedIn. And that's fall of 2013. And so the whole concept and kind of iteration for Blavity is Morgan. Like, that's her brainchild. It's her articulation. And when she had the idea, she was really sharp because she was strategic with who she shared it with. And when she told me about it, one, I thought it was genius, but two, I was just trying to figure out like where I could get involved, because I'm non-technical, but the world of content and media and sort of storytelling is my background and what I love to do. And so that was kind of the way and the iteration of how I sort of got involved on the ground floor, as it were. That's like an abbreviated version of my story. So hopefully that contextualizes some stuff.
Yeah. So you guys didn't start as a media platform. You essentially started as a video platform. So what caused that pivot?
Yeah. So it's interesting because I think we were kind of early. So this is 2014. And it was really about, you know, really propping up different, in my estimation, different alternatives to what was kind of existing. So if you think about 2014, WorldStar is like peaking. Like, and you're talking about, right, like videos hit WorldStar and you're looking at average like 15, 20 million views organic. And so that's a huge traffic driver. And a lot of those videos, like, there were other things also at the same time. So if you think about stuff we take for kind of granted now, like natural hair or beauty tutorials, right? A lot of those people who now have large followings were sort of beginning or in their early gestation stage. And so who we know them now and who they were in 2013, 2014 are different because they were still putting in that early work. And the platform is really surfacing those videos. So there's comedy, you could find inspiration, you could find, again, hair tutorials, you could find stuff that was, I think, kind of a counterbalance. And one of the things that I think we noticed was that people were also being gravitating towards the written content. And I think that was a really, really big sign that, you know, the first idea you have doesn't mean it's bad. It just means you might be early. And so if you think about how you use data, it's not just about like having data. That's important, but it's actually being informed with the right data and having the right flexibility to make the correct decisions and to test your hypothesis. So most of that things have been early stages. Like, can we test this? Cool. Ran it for 2 weeks. What worked? What didn't? Boom. We got traction here. Okay. How do we iterate? And how do we run a different test? And I think that the content side was around, we were profiling people that we knew. And we were finding a lot of traction in that. And we decided to flip that model and kind of actually go the route of more editorial with consistency. And I think that allowed us to have a voice with regularity and to get people used to that. Because at the same time, you're trying to build brand awareness around what Blavity is, what it feels like, how it shows up in people's lives, how it shows up in platforms they're using. What is that? What does it exist to be? And I think those early days are really important to kind of build trust and authenticity in that way.
That's awesome. So now you're an editorial platform and you're building out. At what point do you really start to see things take off?
Yeah, I think if you ask, everybody has a different moment. I think for me, it was February 2015 when we kind of just, numbers started to really grow and get some serious traction. And I think we had put in a lot of work, a lot of time, but it was just incredible to see like month over month growth like that, and to kind of to see that it was the hard work was there, but also that you were beginning to see people kind of open up and to kind of take what they saw and kind of share it and proselytize it. And I think that's really exciting if you find traction, is to kind of watch things move up and to the right, but also realize that people are what helps things move up and to the right. Like your users are helping move up and to the right, and your team alignment and things like that. So I think for me, it was about nine months after launch where I was like, wow, like I'm seeing some of the things that we wrote get recirculated. I'm seeing specific kinds of traction. I'm seeing really, really interesting kind of deviations. And, you know, we're beginning to get into sort of these different news cycles. And, you know, people are excited about the voices. They're excited about the kinds of topics. I think that's just really gratifying if you're a creative to see, you know, what you make, not just being shared, but people championing it and saying, yo, I really felt this. This was meaningful to me. So I think that was a moment where I was like, okay, like this has not just traction, but it means something to people, and there's value, and there's things that are important.
Right. One of the things that I saw very early on was the building of community. And I think a lot of people overlook that. And that's something that you guys started with out the gate. So why do you think building your community up was so important before actually launching the brand to the magnitude that you did?
Well, I mean, you gotta think about, like, we're in the currency is attention, right? Like my friend Alex Wolf talks about this all the time, but it's really a game of how do you capture attention for periods of time. And to come out with a name, first, even a name like Blavity, you have to make, that has to mean something, because it meant something on our campus, but nobody knew what that word meant.
Mm-hmm.
Like there was a time when you could go on Instagram and there were no posts. I remember that vividly, right? That hashtag didn't matter. No one was tagging their pictures. No one was trying to get featured. We were the ones reaching out. And I think to make something matter, you have to ask for permission to enter people's lives. And then once you get that permission, you have to earn it. Because the most valuable thing is also the easiest thing to lose, which is trust.
Right.
So if you're not consistent with that, and you're not finding new ways to add value, and you're not accountable to that, then the answer from a consumer standpoint is always why, right? Like, why are you here? What are you doing? And you have to consistently restate, you know, who you are, what you're doing, and why it matters. And I think that's incredibly critical. No matter what you're building, but if you're building a consumer facing product, and definitely if you're building a media entity or anything that would be informed by that, you have to be thoughtful about how you articulate what you're doing and why you're doing it.
I think that's a good segue into you guys actually branching out to these other brands like Afrotech, 2190, acquiring Shadow and Act Travel Noir. What caused those acquisitions to happen for the other two, but then actually collectively seeing these brands kind of branching out, what made you guys go, okay, these need to be their own separate entities?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, again, credit to Morgan's vision, right? Like she sees things, and then she doesn't just see them. She finds the ability and wherewithal to execute on them. I think also, if you think about things that exist, they need space to be their own. And so if you bring something under sort of a roof, or you have to think about the identity of what you're bringing. And so if you think about like any major acquisition, right, like Microsoft, you know, cops LinkedIn, the purpose of that is not to rebrand LinkedIn in the image of Microsoft. It's mm-hmm. to strategically think about what would integration look like? And integration takes a while. Especially if you're dealing with something at scale and at size like that. I think in terms of Blavity, right, these were communities that were built that people were interested in that had a direct, super, super salient and strong touch point. Like Shadow and Act was one of the earliest places on the internet covering black film on the indie side and major. So these were Tom Bay was writing about Ava DuVernay and Barry Jenkins way before awards were given. right? So if you think about an early adopter, that's like a diehard audience of DPs and people who are EPing and actors and all that. So there's a real community of people that look to Shadow and Act to kind of inform what was on the festival circuit, and agents and casting and people in Hollywood look to that as a place where you can find emerging talent. So, you know, that's important. Travel Noir, same thing. Zim built an incredible audience and community around Black Travel and what that meant. And I think if you think about the expansion of brands and kind of thinking about what people are looking towards, each time you do that, you have to reintroduce an experience or sometimes create a different one that's complementary, but still shares in the ethics and the kind of definition of the core. And I think whether it's an acquisition or it's a branching out, you can use data to inform what that might look like. But then, you know, you never really, really know, but people will let you know how they feel and what they think about and what matters to them.
Right. And so you guys have acquired these companies, and then events come into play, right? So we see Afrotech, we see 2190. Why was that the next transition for you all?
Yeah, so I mean, the first iteration of those were 2016. And I think that's just, you know, people like to commune together. And I think digitally that's one thing, but experiential has always been super important, because what it allows is to make real that which you've already kind of spoken out loud. So to see somebody you've interacted with digitally and to have that experience and have it be intimate and personal, it activates all of your senses, right? So like the one you can't always get digitally is touch and smell. But both of those, like having all five in one place and having it focused and then bringing together kind of these elements that delight people and inspire them and inform them and hold them accountable, and to kind of test and see like what those integrations would look like, I think is important. But also from a revenue standpoint, you need to think about, you know, how are you going to switch your mix up? So if you know people are interested in this kind of content or these kinds of things, what would that look like in a tangible way, in a time-bound manner, and something that is repeatable? Right. So the first experience, the first time they gather, like, what does that need to feel like?
Right.
What kinds of things can you do there that, you know, you might not be able to just do that would make it really special? That would make it memorable. That would make it, I can't wait until the next time this happens.
So now this media conglomerate is at the top of its top, at least from the outsider looking in. Right. So we see all of these things going on, and then you announce your exit. What was that about?
Yeah, so why did I leave?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think there are a couple of things. One, I think it was time, right? Like, I'm the kind of person who I felt like I generally know when I should be moving. Whether I listen to that is another thing entirely. I think Blavity as an entity and as a business is in the most capable hands with, you know, Aaron Morgan and Jeff. And I also felt like there were certain questions that I kind of had that I wanted to answer. And I had to think about whether I was best equipped to explore those, also given the realities of what I needed to be doing. And you can, I think, in life get to experience that which you want, but not without compromise and making choices. And so my choices were around, you know, what does next look like for me, and what will that require of me? And I look at my life and the things I care about and what matters. And those are my decisions. And I think, for anybody, building a business, joining an early stage business, anything related to ownership, like there's always a reality of the trade-off. And for me, that reality has just been about understanding like what I think some of my work needs to look like and what that's going to require of me over the short term, but also the long term. And I think those were some of the major factors in terms of me, you know, realizing it was time and trying to really do that gracefully and be just super grateful that I got a chance to be a part of it. And I'm incredibly grateful for that and the time and the things I've learned and, you know, the mistakes I made and the L's I took, some public, some not, but all of that is a blessing for me.
I love that you say that because a lot of people think that ish has to absolutely like hit the fan for you to move on, but it could just be like a pivotal moment in your life. So talk a little bit more about that. Like, what was that moment in your life where you were like, hey, listen, like I want to try some other things?
Yeah, you know, I'm a polymath, so that means that I like to learn a bunch of different things, and I'm also an autodidact, so I like to teach myself new things, and that's where I feel like I'm at my best. And so the combination of those two things often means that I like to exist at the edge of my experience level. So I'm the kind of person who enjoys the difficulty of being a novice. Like I like the challenge of not really knowing and walking into places and being brand new. Cause I find I'm at my most creative. Cause I don't know the rules. I don't know the limits. I don't know the perceived things you're supposed to do. I don't know the right decorum. I just know I'm here. And for me, I wanted to start thinking about some of these larger things that I was hearing and seeing and around the ecosystem and really get a more thorough understanding of the moment in time we're in. And I think to do that, I had to really ask myself, like, where could I go get better? And this is a question that kind of haunts me a little bit because it can be really interesting when you gain any sort of credibility or level of expertise. One of the major challenges I've come across is how you get better, and the things you use to train yourself have to improve at the same level you're improving. So I needed to go around people who were better than good. Like I wanted to be around great in a very different arena. And so that led me to the Nieman Foundation, where people are excellent at the craft of journalism and storytelling and thinking about the future of media, what that's going to look like, not just domestically, but globally. And that was an experience I'd never had before. And, you know, it was humbling for a couple reasons, but mainly because you just understand like how much you do not know. Like there are so many things I am blissfully unaware of. And, you know, that requires you to kind of sit down and to have a beginner's pose and be okay with that and understand that that's part of the growth you want. And it's part of my growth. So I've been kind of in that headspace for a good amount of time, and it's been delightful.
I love it. I want to talk more about your journey to Harvard and what you're working on now. But before we get into that, I think a general question that we should definitely address is what actually happens when you exit the company as a founder?
Yeah, so I mean, I think it depends. One of the things I think for anybody exiting or anything kind of specific to that is thinking about your succession plan. So, and this I think is more broadly applicable to anyone in a leadership position, but like having one of those is critical because there's a bunch of things that you've probably done over time that have become second nature to you. You can do them blind, but they're not second nature to anyone else. And so not having a record of that or not being able to kind of explicate what those are can leave people in a very tenuous position, because if the role is going to get backfilled or if it's going to get spread across a few different things, you kind of need to have some documentation around here's what I was doing, here's what it looked like, here's what's open, here are the projects that are kind of still out in the world. I think the communication to, you know, internal stakeholders in the team is super critical around, you know, here's what's happening. It's amicable, so on and so forth. I think then just getting really clear on sort of relationships you've had, just so people aren't taken by surprise and, you know, things like out of offices and just making sure that there's, as well as you can, minimal disruption to whatever it is you're doing and kind of getting into next are some of the tactical ways. I think there's obviously an emotional component to that that I think is important to talk about. I mean, it's hard. If you spend time doing something over a period of time, there is grief involved. And everybody's journey is different. Mine, I think, required me to just wrestle with my ego, you know, in a really, really personal way. Because, I mean, it's kind of like Mitch said in Paid in Full, right? Like, if I leave the game, are they going to miss me?
Mm.
Like, are they going to love me? Right? And, like, that's a real thing. At least for me, it was. Like, who am I now that I don't do this?
Right, because your identity is wrapped into
your name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it's like it's your identity, right? There's like you're this person, but like does anything come before your name? Is there like a John Jackson from, or does my name stand alone? And there's an insecurity there because if your name was always a comma and there's something else, if there's no comma, then like how much of your identity was tied to what you used to do, as opposed to this is the work that I do, not who I am. And that's a really tenuous balance if, you know, the responsibility was high. And that's inner work. But to me, it's the most critical because to emerge from that with your psyche intact, you have to kind of deal with that fallout you have within yourself. Like, do I matter? What, if so, how? If so, what matters? And who am I going to be in lieu of these choices I've made? And, you know, I think sometimes if you don't do that work, other people end up being the collateral of that.
Mm.
And that gets really, really messy. And it's people you care about, people you love. And, you know, ego is a savage, not just because it blows your head up, but it makes you think that it's okay. And that I think is one of those things that I'm hyper conscious of now. It's like managing my own sometimes incessant need to still feel valuable.
Mm.
And the lengths you might go to feel valuable, even though it's not the thing you should be doing. And kind of dealing with that and really getting clear on where that comes from, the insecurity that comes from. It comes way before you start a business. So you gotta really peel some layers back in your life and some formative experiences and really just be like, hey, like, what's prompting this? Because getting a new gig or starting something else won't take this away. So like being a serial entrepreneur does not remove your insecurity. It just means you find a new vehicle to put your insecurity inside of.
That's powerful. So how did you unravel that?
Yeah, man, it's a lot of therapy. Like, I'm just gonna hold you. Like, I took my ass straight to therapy. And I mean, it's not something I'm unfamiliar with, but I think there are different iterations of what you want to get out of it. And for me, it was just like, where are my gaps? Like, where are my relational gaps? Like, what do I have trouble doing that might come easy to other people? Not like skill wise, but just like, where is this turmoil even coming from? Like, I'm a high functioning person. I think I'm reasonably intelligent, but there's just some stuff that I'm just really trash at. And just for some reason, there's no HBR article that's going to get me there. Right. Like, there's
right.
No like Forbes listing that's going to like really help me. So I had to really sit down and take stock of my emotional life and think about, you know, generally across my 20s, like where are these consistent pattern loops that repeat? And most of those for me are interpersonal. They're not professional. So the biggest gaps for me were actually in like how I dealt with people during years, formative experiences where I was professionally successful, right? Like there was always a cost. And I think that there is a lot of rhetoric around paying those costs and sort of sacrifice and all that. And I think that's true. But I all think we make a choice about the kind of life we want to live. And what we will sacrifice and what we won't. And getting clearer on what those things are. like being able to speak on like, here, I'm in a season of this, so I am okay if this doesn't get done. And being intentional and specific about that for me was really powerful, because it let me realize that like, there are some balls that are glass and some that are rubber, and it's okay to drop a rubber ball. But these glass ones, let me not get confused between which is what is glass and what is rubber. And those balls look different for people, and my balls are different. So, and they change sometimes. I think they shift as you get older and your priorities change and you want different things, and you have to be okay acknowledging that. And I think for me, that was really freeing to be like, this is a glass ball now, and I want to keep this close. And because of that, I will amend my life so I have these kinds of experiences, because I feel healthy with this.
That's so interesting. So when you left, you obviously were still going through that kind of unraveling of your identity and trying to figure out what you needed. Did that change the outlook of where you ended up after the fact, after getting all of the therapy that you went through?
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know. I think it changed my experience to where I was. So to be clear, I would have gotten dragged through this process regardless. So either I was going to go crawling or I was going to go walking, but either way I was going. So the choices I made were about the state I would be in when I entered into that unraveling. That was intentional. So I think it changed how I experienced what I've been through, because I've been in tune to like how I feel. Like I'm very, very aware of like, how am I responding to this new stimulus? Not like, because I think that there's a difference between getting better and feeling better.
Right.
Like feeling better can be temporal. I'm gonna go watch an episode of something funny. I might go work out. Like I'll do things to restore myself. For me, getting better is always a process of deep. It is deeply revealing and unnerving, because in my experience, getting better requires leaving a part of you that is unhealthy, but it might be the part of you that you're most familiar with. And that does not feel good. That is not like, you know, 1200 thread count sheets and like writing in your moleskin on a beach. Like that's right. Not, you're not in a villa. That's not villa work. That's like, I'm in album mode. Haven't gotten a haircut in 3 weeks. I look like a vagabond. Like that's what that looks like for me.
Right.
And you have to be compassionate with yourself in that process.
Impatient,
especially if your public persona is completely different. So you don't even, there are periods where I haven't even recognized myself during growth. I've been like, who is this guy? who are you? And I think, you know, I've been grateful that I have a very, very, very solid circle of people in my life that have kind of seen me do a lot of ebbs and flows. And they have just been able to love on me when I have been incapacitated and some frankly disappointed with myself. And I think that's been a really, I just have so much gratitude. They show me so much grace, because that evolution process, it takes time. Like you said, you have to be patient. It's sometimes I think people want to IPO in their personal life. Like they want to be unicorns in their life. And like, that's not how it works. Like they want a Slack IPO like 3 months in.
Right.
Like this new version of themselves. And you're the investor. It's you. Like you're the growth capital.
Yeah. I mean, you can't get there without doing the work. That's for sure.
No. No way.
So then what were next steps for you? You went to Harvard, or you're going to Harvard. You're studying journalism. Tell me more about what you're going through at this moment.
Yeah. So the program just ended in May, actually. So the Nieman Foundation for Journalism is a program at Harvard that was it's about 80 years old. And so it brings together about 28 of the world's foremost kind of journalists and people in media to think about elevating the standards of journalism is kind of the charge That's pretty broad because it looks differently depending on where people are coming from. And so it's a year-long fellowship program in which you are given complete access to all of Harvard's resources and MIT. You're able to audit courses across any professional school. So Harvard College, Harvard Law School, Harvard Business School, Kennedy School, the School of Education, and any of the extension school affiliates. And essentially, if you really want to, any school in the greater Boston area. There are seminars, there are kind of deep learning activities, and all of those things were incredible. But for me, the cohort of people that like I've spent time around is just unparalleled. So like I said, half the class is international. So my class was people from a woman from Crimea, a woman who won a Pulitzer for exposing maritime slavery in the Pacific and freed 2,000 slaves. And she's from Myanmar. She's an enemy of the state. She cannot go home.
Wow.
Because it's an oppressive regime. Like, so you got like this. This is like her life. Like that. Like these are all facts. You know, there's another data journalist from Israel, a photographer from Colombia, who was photographing a lot of the insurgent and some of the pretty extreme upheaval that's happened in the country post a lot of the Contra wars. A journalist from Puerto Rico who's covering corruption around a lot of things happening with FEMA. So it's just people doing like incredible work. And so you kind of sit down and for me, I had to sit and think about how these people went about their work with limited resources under threat of violence, kidnap, torture, death, and just the standards they held themselves to. Like forget like work and how difficult it is, but like the standards of how they behave and how they, the rigor that they expect of themselves. And the commitment to their craft and to telling stories and how important those stories are. And, you know, there's a woman from Turkey, and that's an oppressive political regime, right? So she had one of the highest rated cable programs. And every night, the government could turn off the internet any night. Like, it was hard for me to think about like doing your best work in an environment like that, where at any point, because they felt like it, they could come to the station and be like, why are you doing this?
It's control.
And be like, but so what? So what? Right? Like that choice, was sobering. Right. And so that's the kind of people I spent the past year kind of immersed with and just learning from them and being like, how do you do your work? How do you, find new stories? How do you curate sources? How do you publish? How do you edit? What do you look for when you edit? And to me, that was just incredible because, like I said, I'm okay at what I do, but I'm not great. And for me, like I need to get closer to I need to understand what great looks like. And I have a much clearer picture of what that is. But it's hard to give yourself that picture when you're doing things that other people around you aren't doing. Mm. So I had to bring myself closer to what that greatness looked like. And just so I could get proximate and around, and I could breathe in what they were doing, and I could mimic what they were doing, and I could understand, you know, how they approach their work and how they tell these stories about people and how they're of service and how they give, how they take care of themselves. All that was, I needed all of that. So it was beautiful.
That's an incredible sacrifice. What lens do you see yourself telling stories from?
Yeah. So I think I've expanded. I'm interested in like nuance, and I'm interested in the time we're in now with, you know, the amount of people you've had on this show, on your show, right? Like people like Demetra Wilson and Sheena Allen and Everett Taylor and Ruben Harris and, you know, Sheen and just tons of people just doing incredible work. And I think like 20 years from now, like, what does that story look like? Like what, like, what, like what will we, how will we contextualize the history we're living through right now? Mm. Because we know what happens when you aren't the author and how distorted that can be and how easily a narrative can be weaponized when it's not contextual, or it can just be erased. And so I think about how to avoid erasure in a time where everything feels so fleeting. So how do you be thoughtful about what we archive and how we archive it? Mm. And that's what I'm convicted by. I'm convicted by all these stories. And sometimes I feel like Professor X, like I feel like I go in this room and I put on the helmet and there's just so many things going on. Like people are just popping everywhere. And I think it's incredible. Like what a time to be alive for real. And I think about my goddaughter who's 2 and I'm like, okay, when she's 10, what stories will we be reading together?
Or even how will you be consuming those stories, right?
Yeah, right. So yeah, first, you know, how are we bringing it? Like, where are we going? Second, how are they getting to her? Third, what are the mediums? And fourth, how can I make sure that she's getting the most accurate information about how those things started, about what those challenges were, about what people survived through, about who people were, about the realities of the environments they were in, all of that matters. And that's the kind of work that I think about. And I think about media is still the most powerful entity on the planet, in my opinion, because it has the ability to transport people into a future they haven't seen yet, or remind them of a past they were not aware of, but could affirm them. And can give them viewpoints into a present that they might not be privy to, given whatever thing they are, whatever constraints are in their life.
That's so powerful, just to understand even that perspective and looking at journalism through that lens. I think it's going to be really interesting what you end up doing. So how do we follow your work and see where you're going and what's happening, just so we can stay abreast of what's going on?
Yeah, so I'm on the socials at John Jackson, JON_Jackson. I have had a difficult relationship with like posting consistently, and it's not because I don't want to. It's because I really struggle with like how to be thoughtful about what I want to say. One of the things I'm committing to on the back half of this year is to just be a little more specific. I'm working on over the course of my year at Neiman, I spent a lot of time writing. And so I've essentially constructed what I think can be a really useful newsletter. So I'm going to try and get that out before the end of the year. And it'll be long form, but it'll really tackle some of these things I've been thinking about in terms of influence, in terms of narrative construction, nuance, and things that I think are just at least top of mind for me that I'm, again, not an expert on, but there are things I'm willing to kind of dig deep into. So I'll make sure people are aware of that. But, yeah, I'm on Instagram and Twitter. I'll try not to lurk as much. I'll try to be a little more engaged. That's my promise to myself and my homies who have huge followings that I'm always like, nah, man, you got it. But I'm trying to get more involved.
That's what's up. Well, thank you so much for sharing all of those gems with us. We are super excited to see what you have going on. I definitely am going to stay abreast completely.
This is The Plug.
You know who's The Plug.
It's time to get caught up on the hottest in tech.
Keep it locked, you heard.
With Sequoia Blodgett.
I see you, little mama.
Commas is a community of like-minded startup entrepreneurs with the goal of being profitable. We focus on helping founders gain an understanding of how to build an online, digital, or tech-enabled business through courses, coaching, and support. So what does that mean? Well, we have a program for new entrepreneurs with no or minimal prior business experience looking to go from zero to a growing startup. That includes courses in entrepreneurship mindset, product development, branding, marketing, publicity, fundraising and business formation, pretty much everything you need to get your company off the ground. In addition to that, we have a new program for established entrepreneurs looking to scale their startups with automated sales funnels and paid advertising. We also help them focus on hiring and managing a team. If you're interested, log on to commasclub.com for more information. Until next week, it's your girl Sequoia, and I'm out.